97.9 FM, WCHL, and chapelboro.com present The Art of Potential, an illuminating talk show dedicated to getting your community educated, hired, and inspired. The Art of Potential combines real-world knowledge and expertise aimed at helping our community reach their full potential. Now, The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
This is Kristen Heemstra with the Art of Potential Show. Welcome. We are so glad you are joining us. Today we have a very, very interesting show for you. We have our guest on, Debbie Steer. Welcome, Debbie.
Hi, Kristen.
Hi. And for those of you who listen to the show regularly, Debbie's voice will be familiar. She is the author of this Perfect Score Project, and she is the woman who went and took the SAT 7 times.
Yes, I did. Crazy as that sounds, I did it. I was everything there is to know, so you don't have to.
Right, exactly. One of the things that Debbie learned in the process was how to work with and motivate her own children. And she has two very different children. So the show, we're going to talk about the SAT, but we're also going to talk about that very important fact, because right now both those things are very relevant to our community. So,
yeah.
So Debbie, actually, first things first, tell us, is what's new with your book, Perfect Score Project? Is there any big news there?
Well, the big news is it will be published in paperback, and it's coming out on September 9th.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So exciting. And for those of you who aren't familiar with this book, it is so fantastic, the Perfect Score Project. I read it. I have it. I have my poor daughter already in line with Kumon, and she's already doing SAT prep in the 9th grade. And yesterday we were talking about runways, thanks to you, Debbie. She knows the difference between a steep runway and a long runway.
I love it.
In terms of preparation. So I highly recommend the book. And again, paperback is a really, really big deal. So let's talk a little bit, Debbie, about you and your journey with your son, Ethan. Now, you decided to rope him into this project when he was a junior. Is that right?
It was the end of his sophomore
year. End of sophomore year. Okay.
Yep. And he was a kid who was happy-go-lucky, sweet as pie, but he was not the most motivated kid. And I was looking around and I was reading everybody with these, 4-point-something GPAs. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know you could have over 4.0 until then. And, everyone had lots of extracurriculars and, this and that. And, unfortunately for Ethan, he had a series of unfortunate events. Freshman year, he had concussions that knocked him out of sports, pretty much for good, actually. And, he lost his memory for a while. Thankfully, he got it back.
Wow.
It was terrible for the GPA. Sophomore year, things were looking better. And then I guess it was Thanksgiving vacation. He came down with the worst case of mono I've ever seen and basically slept his entire sophomore year. Again, terrible for the GPA. So here we were at the end of sophomore year, and he was a kid with a B average. And, he was more excited about hanging out with his friends over the summer than studying for the SAT. He couldn't see into the future, what the opportunity of doing well on the SAT and also the liability of not doing well, which, by the way, is normal. I felt it was my job as his mother to, share with him what, the potential might be, cost and otherwise. So anyway, I decided to get into this SAT and share the experience with him in an effort to motivate him. And what I discovered was that he was not trailing behind like he was supposed to.
And the mother duck has left and there's no baby behind her.
Exactly. I had become so obsessed because, I thought it was fun and I get really into something and sometimes I can lose the thread. I'm so into the, into the forest and the weeds that I didn't realize that what had happened, here my son had finished 10th grade and you were referring to Kumon. I thought the big awakening for me actually happened in Kumon. I took my son as a 10th grader to Kumon, or summer going into 11th grade, because I thought we'd do summer worksheets together. That was my idea of a good time. I was going to bond with him, and that was not. And he rebelled like he had never rebelled before. And I was stunned. I was devastated. I couldn't believe that my little chickadee wasn't following behind. And I guess most importantly, I was at a loss for how to get it, like, for where to go.
So
I mean, it was bad.
Well, and so it sounds like you also took it very personally.
Yes. Because, well, I mean, and I will say this, that I've now, heading, midway through or a little more than that with my second teenager, and I do see this a lot with my friends and their teenagers. It's really hard not to take it personally.
Mm-hmm.
Teenagers attack you, their parents, you're their beloved parents who they adore until they're teenagers, and then they're trying to dismantle your authority, and they're taking out all of their problems on you, but you don't even realize they're being rude and disrespectful because of something that happened at school with a girl or whatever. And so, yeah, that was one big mistake that I made, was to take it all personally, and, boy, did I learn. It's not personal. It's not okay for them to treat me that way, but it also wasn't personal. I was definitely very hurt, and I think that is common. I hear that a lot from parents that, when your kid rejects you, it really hurts.
Absolutely, and you don't realize that they're rejecting you because you're safe, because you as a parent have laid that foundation of unconditional love for them, and so... they're lost. They don't know what's going on in that moment. And they know can lash out at you and you won't disown them like their friends their teachers.
That's right. So it's your job as a parent to just, to be unconditional, like you said. And, I do believe that there has to be a large degree of respect, but I also think that the respect has to go both ways.
Yes.
And it's about the relationship. It's not about the behavior. And that, I guess, was the big lesson to me, that I needed to go back and relationship build, because here I was thinking he was just going to do what I said he should do because I was his mother. And why would we ever question that? But the fact of the matter is, our relationship wasn't strong enough at that time to, for me to make him do that. He was big enough not to do it. And his North Star had become his friends.
Yes.
And his friends were not studying for the SAT. His friends were out having a good time. And, that was his North Star that summer. And I had to figure out how to recollect him and reclaim my rightful place as his mother. And, it was inadvertent how I found my way back. But once I did, it all just became very clear.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I want to hear about this because, to your point, teenagers' North Stars are their peer group. They get them. They, have so much in common with them. In much the same way adults' peers are often their North Stars, too. You bounce ideas off of them.
Right.
And so I do have to ask, when you were a teenager, did you follow your parents around?
Like, not at all.
Yeah.
No. This is an issue that's been ongoing and developing, since the Industrial Revolution, when we invented schools. And we, if you look
invented
at it in
teenagers.
Nature,
teenagers.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's when teenagers were invented. I always say, if you look out into nature, my daughter laughs when I say this. I go, but you don't see a bunch of 15-year-old bears hanging out in the woods together. You see mommy bear and baby bear and cousin bear and grandpa bear. But, this, putting a bunch of kids the same age together for years, that's a man-made invention. And it ends up causing some problems. Sometimes the problems are worse than other problems. But, the parent has to be, and the teacher has to be, it has to be hierarchical for it to work. And I'll give you one example in nature that shows this. I think it was South Africa. There was a 60 Minutes episode where they decided that they were going to have the baby elephants in a park, in a zoo. And so they took away all the grown-up elephants, and the baby elephants started being bullies, and they started picking on the rhinos. And it was disorder and chaos, and it got terrible. And to bring back order, they brought the the daddy elephants back, and the daddy elephants restored the order.
Oh,
and so it's got to be like the natural order of things is hierarchical. And so,
and then there's Lord of the Flies, right?
Exactly. And so it's a terrible idea, you know, and it's, you know, what's normal and what's natural are not necessarily the same thing. So it's normal in our culture for peers right. to use their friends as the North Star. We encourage that. We say they're supposed to individuate, and they're supposed to be with their friends more, and that's normal, but that's not necessarily
natural.
And I, you know, would argue that it's not necessarily desirable, or and can be incredibly dangerous depending on your kid.
Yeah.
You know, in the case of my son, it probably would have been, you know, he probably would have floated down to the level that I allowed him to. But in the case of somebody like my, and so I was saving him from underachieving, okay?
You were the savior figure. You will not underachieve.
Yeah. But with my daughter, you know, she's extremely sensitive, and to have peers as your North Star, I mean, that's you know, dangerous and can be right. even lethal. And that's when, you know, these kids who bully each other, I mean, you know, kids are not meant to be raising other kids. They're not right. meant to be the North
yeah,
Star. So I didn't realize any of this at the time. All I knew was that my kid was not doing what I said he should do, and that was the first time he ever defied me.
Wow.
And I was apoplectic. I mean, I was devastated. I was angry. You know, I didn't know whether to punish him. It was awful. And what I did was I called my friend Catherine, who had a very happy, wonderful family, and her kids did what she wanted them to do, and which was very rare. Because, by the way, the town that I was living in, it was pretty normal for kids to be disrespectful, for teenagers to be disrespectful to their parents. So that was also the behavior they were seeing. But my friend Catherine's son was not like that, and her family did stuff together. They went on vacations together. They watched TV together. They had family dinners together. And they, you know, more than that, they seemed happy together. So I called Catherine, and I was crying. And, you know, here it was actually about time for Ethan to really start studying for the SAT. And I couldn't even get him to do a worksheet with me. And I was crying, and I said, Catherine, what do I do? And she said, well, watch a funny TV show together. And I said, well, we don't have a TV. And she just stopped. And she said, you don't have a TV? And I said, no. And she said, well, that's ridiculous. You have to have a TV. All families have TVs. And you have to have a neutral place where it's not heated. And you know, I've learned so much since then. But, you know, I immediately ordered a huge screen TV. And that began what has, you know, endured as an everyday tradition. At the end of the day, we watch, you know, one to two, sometimes three episodes of a funny TV show together. And we pick, you know, we usually have one show going, whether it's, you know, I don't know, 30 Rock or Parks and Rec or The Office. And
we do Modern Family. Yeah.
Modern Family, we did. That was one of us.
Yeah.
And we do it from beginning to end. And it's, you know, especially with teenagers where it's heated and volatile. And, you know, that was where it was. Where I was with Ethan.
It's like your touchstone.
That's safe territory. You know, no one's going to refuse to sit down and watch a funny TV show with you. And then you're laughing together. And that laughing is very healing.
Oh.
And so anyway, that was how we ended up, you know, the beginning, the little seedlings of rebuilding our relationship. And we did that for a good few weeks, maybe even a month. And I even watched TV over dinner. I mean, I did everything, and, you know, we started laughing about the shows and then referencing them and then laughing about the jokes a day or two later. And so then there became this positive association. And Ethan was the one who said to me one day, hey, Mom, you want to do a section together, meaning an SAT section?
Wow.
And I always said that was like his olive branch back.
Right.
And you know what I mean? Like that was
right.
me saying, all right, we're okay now. And what
in teenage language, yeah.
That's, yes.
Yeah. Listen, let's take a break, ahead. And then when we come back, I want to hear more about this.
Okay.
You are listening to the Art of Potential show. This is Kristen Heemstra talking with Debbie Steer. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra with the Art of Potential show, and I am talking with Debbie Steer. She is the author of The Perfect Score Project, which comes out in paperback soon. And we're talking actually about how to connect with your teenager. Debbie, you had to do that with Ethan to try to get him to study for the SAT. And in the last segment, you were talking about how you rebuilt your relationship through comedy television.
Yeah, it was so, and that endures today. That's the last thing we do before we go to bed. We watch an episode or two or even three of a funny TV show, and it's a really nice way to end the day. But after we did the TV show, and about a month later, he said, "Mom, you want to do a section?" And I knew, you know, I could feel the warmth. I could feel underneath the ground that there were some roots that had started to grow. And so I said, you know, yes, let's do a section. And I did a section, and then I kind of knew when to leave the party while we were still having fun, and then we built from there. And then, you know, we did a little more, but I took it, I was very ginger about it. I made sure the roots of our relationship were strong before I tried to, you know, push too hard. And so ultimately, and again, this is in hindsight, I didn't realize any of this when I was, you know, about to go through it or even in it. It was only reflecting back on it. But the SAT, doing it with my kid, was an incredibly time-consuming project.
Yes.
So whether your kid is doing it as, with a class or, you know, with a tutor or on their own, it's time-consuming. My son did it with me. So little did I know, at this critical juncture in his life when his eye had just turned to his friends and they were becoming more important than me, their opinion, suddenly I miraculously got him back, you know, a little bit through these funny TV shows. And now that he was back, we were about to embark on this incredibly time-consuming project. And, you know, it was a school year-long project, and we spent a lot of time together because we did the full-timed practice test on Saturday morning, which
oh my gosh.
Yeah, which meant that he couldn't go out on Friday night. So, you know, that was a bitter pill to swallow at first, staying home with mom on Friday nights when he, you know, liked to go out with all the other kids. And but then he found a pretty girl up the street who was also doing that. And so the three of us would often, you know, see a movie at dinner. And then they would go home, you know, get a good night's sleep, and then take the practice test in the morning.
So she was with you taking the practice test?
No, she didn't do it with us,
okay.
But she would spend Friday night and, you know, Friday, you know, see the movie, have dinner, and then she would go home, sleep there, take her own test, and then she'd come back after, and they'd compare notes. How'd you do? How'd you do? That's another thing I'm going to say about the motivation.
Wow.
Having a pretty girl down the street who was doing it, and he wanted to beat her, and they were neck and neck, and it definitely kept him on his toes. So that was another good way to motivate him.
Totally.
Yeah. The other thing I'll say was, you know, at the school and in the town that we went to, the general feeling was that you take the college tours junior year, and then they tell you, if you're traveling somewhere sophomore year, sure, stop by. But I would argue that, you know, the earlier you do it, freshman year is probably a little too early, but certainly sophomore year is a very good time, because by the time you get to junior year, like we did, the cake is baked. Like your GPA, there's
yeah.
not that much you can do about it. So
right.
if you go to Boston and you see the perfect college, and then you get back and you look at what your chances are, boy, that's sad. There's not that much you can do.
Right, you're done. Yes.
You're done, exactly. So why not, you know, peek at a few early on, see if you can envision yourself there. Do you like a big college? Do you like a city college outside the city, a campus? And just sort of get the vision going so that, you know, it can drive, you know, it can drive them to work harder for sure. They always say that, the tutors all tell me, and this is true, that they see vocabulary as a barometer of, you know, how motivated the kid is. If the kid's not studying the vocab, that's a bad sign.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, they don't. There's no shortcut around the vocabulary because, you know, the vocabulary is in the reading, too. All kids want to know what's the shortcut to the vocab. Well, guess what? It's not. There's no shortcut. You have to learn the vocabulary. It's not a fast process. The best way to do it, I would say, is to read. The most interesting place to find it and to read it is the New York Times. That would be really the best way to start studying early for it. And back to motivating your kid, one thing I've done with my daughter, and actually I now do it with my son too, is we read the New York Times together every day and we discuss the articles. And every single New York Times article has, I'm going to say, 530 SAT words.
Wow.
So that is a really good exercise that can start, you know, a ninth grader, you know, you can start reading it then and discuss the vocabulary and bring it up and, you know, test them. Don't say, do you know that word? Because they're all going to say yes. Say, use it in a sentence for me. Because oftentimes, even if they can say the definition, they'll get a nuance wrong. They'll use it sort of in a wrong context. Anyway, that's a good way to stay connected and have interesting things to talk about and study for the SAT without officially studying for the SAT.
Well, and what I loved about your story is you were a publisher. Like, you, all you did was consume books for years and years and years. And there is this theory that, you know, getting a higher reading score is really difficult. But you said your score went up 80 points.
Right. So my score, they say the average SAT reading score goes up 5 to 10 points after test prep, which means some scores go down after test prep. What I think after, you know, I was, for all intents and purposes, I did not raise my math score. I went up from 510 to 570. My reading score and my writing score both improved significantly, 330 points in total.
Wow.
And my theory is that if you have a strong foundation test and good test prep, with good test prep, you can improve your SAT score. But without a strong foundation, I did not have a strong foundation in math, no amount of test prep is going to help you. And so it's like unbaking a cake. Imagine, you know, because each, you know, SAT question, I'm going to use the math for an example right now, has a whole bunch of things baked into it. So imagine it's like a brownie, you know, and there's nuts and there's sugar and there's chocolate and there's all these things. There's so many things in each little problem that to try and learn it through tricks, it doesn't work. Versus if you know, you know, what all the ingredients are, then you can do it. You can fix it with a little, you can ice it. But so I had a strong foundation in the reading and the writing, and so I had great test prep, and I was able to improve my score by 330 points, which again, you know, the average score gain is 5 to 10.
Wow, which I didn't know. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to learn more about preparing for this test and also motivating your teenager. You are listening to Kristen Heemstra with the Art of Potential Show.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra, and I'm having a fascinating conversation with Debbie Steer. She is the author of The Perfect Score Project. And Debbie, you were just saying in the last segment that the average, tell me that again, the average gain after you take an SAT prep class is what?
Well, it doesn't, they put all test prep together. So,
right.
Class, tutor, and they didn't pull it apart. But on the College Board's website, there's a study, and it says the average score gain after test prep is 5 to 10 points for the critical reading and 10 to 20 points for the math. And they also note that some people's scores go down after test prep. And so it's actually pretty clear to me, having gone so deeply into it, what the issue is, that most people don't have a strong foundation. We also, by the way, don't know what we don't know.
Right.
So people don't have a strong foundation, and then most people don't do good test prep. And so you do bad test prep on top of a weak foundation, and you get 5 points or less, you know, on your score afterwards.
Which, you know, and there's so, it's such a million-dollar industry. I mean, so many people are doing it. It's just amazing to me that they're laying out that kind of money for such little result. So,
yeah,
you know.
$4.5 billion industry. Yes.
Wow. Billions of dollars.
Billion, yeah. Yeah.
All right. So you have your own version, though, of what people who are preparing should do.
Right. And I would say, you know, certainly if you have time, if you have a kid who's, you know, 10th grade or younger, you know, and even, by the way, if your kid is a rising junior right now, firm up that foundation. And so what do I mean by firm up that foundation? What you're doing, Kristen, with your kids, Kumon is a great way to firm up the math. The New York Times, which I just mentioned, reading it together. Now, most of the reading on the SAT is nonfiction. There's one fiction passage per test. What most kids are reading in school is fiction.
Yeah, it is.
And so it's very unfamiliar. Think of it, it's like New Yorker reading, or harder even.
Right.
And most kids are not experienced in that. The other thing with reading is that background knowledge and vocabulary, the more you have, the more you have. They call it the Matthew effect. So there's no making it. So if you're reading a passage on the SAT about dualism and Descartes and Copernicus, if you don't know what dualism is in Descartes and Copernicus, that's going to be a lot harder for you. And there's, they have, you know, they go into some pretty sophisticated topics. So the more you read, you know, that's non-school stuff, and I think, you know, the New York Times and the New Yorker and that level publication is a really good way to go. And not to mention, it's interesting. Most kids can flip through the newspaper and find something they're interested in. And, you know, or the New Yorker, you can always find one article, and it is written at that level. But the other trick, I'm going to say this too, is to get used to reading stuff you're not interested in.
Right.
There's always a passage on the SAT that is just,
deadly dull and boring.
Exactly. So anyway, shore up the foundation. That's the best advice I can give you if you're, you know, at any point in time, work on that.
And so kids go through that, they shore up their foundation, and then they head off to the testing center. And one thing I would like to say, which I'm not sure people are aware of, is this. The SAT is it's used in college admission extensively. It is what the nation uses to set the bar. So if you have a GPA in one high school and a GPA in another high school, they don't have necessarily a good way to gauge what the actual rigor of the curriculum was. And the SAT is how they measure that, so how they set the bar across the nation. So they know a 4.0 here equals roughly this SAT score, and a 4.0 there equals a different SAT score. And that is called your potential when they review your application. That's what they're looking for. The other thing about the SAT is that it's often the gateway to scholarships.
Yes, merit aid. People don't understand, and I didn't really understand, the difference between merit aid and loans and scholarships, and they all mean, or not all, but you know, they can mean different things at different colleges. But, you know, even the schools that, many of the schools that say that they are test optional, you know, or, you know, test flexible, which means that, you know, you don't have to submit your scores. Oftentimes, they do want your scores when it comes to merit aid. Now, merit aid is the free money. Merit aid is the money that you don't have to pay back. That's the money
we like
want,
merit
know?
Aid.
Exactly.
Yes.
I mean, who doesn't want to, you know, I mean, what's the average college tuition at a private college now? It's probably close to $60,000 a year.
It's crazy.
You know, you don't want to graduate with too much debt. You want the free money. And oftentimes, the SAT plays a role in that, and we don't even know how much of a role, but
very much so.
You know, so it definitely helps.
It does, and it's unfortunate that that's the way it is, but it also is the way it is. So you kind of have to get over how you feel about it and look at it and kind of tackle it at, to your point, you know, one day at a time, one article at a time, because the test itself really does open up doors and make a huge difference. And I'll be honest, we're talking about the SAT, but the ACT is the same way. I'm not trying to discriminate. I'm just saying, you know, we're just talking about that. But the ACT is the same way. Any type of standardized testing is a huge gate opener for people.
Yeah. And there have been articles recently that companies are using the SAT, your SAT score from high school.
Yes.
That's the gate to get in to get an interview.
Yes.
You know, with the economy the way it is, hundreds of applicants for these jobs, they're starting with What is your SAT score? So it has ramifications that go beyond college.
Which is scary. I interviewed a young man, Brett Derby, for a different show, and he graduated from a local high school here. Fantastic kid. And he's really done a great job of making a career for himself. And, you know, I've kind of followed him over the years. But he was telling me that the firm, now he got a big job in a great firm, but the first thing they asked him for was his SAT scores. And he was like, seriously? But yes, they wanted
Could
to see
imagine?
Those. No.
Yeah. And it's happening more and more. There have been stories in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times just within the last couple of months saying that it's, you know, they're asking for the scores more and more.
Wow. So one of the things that I know that you've encountered is how people feel about the test. So can we talk a moment about the psychology of the SAT now that we just laid out how much it matters in your life?
They reviled this test. I actually didn't anticipate that. I thought, well, first of all, I liked the test. I realized I'm an anomaly because I actually find it fun. It's like puzzles to me. So it's like Sudoku or crossword puzzles. But what I didn't anticipate is how angry people are about the test and how unfair it is and this and that. And all that very well might be true. It's just that it's a reality. It is what it is. And so I didn't see it as my job or my mission to go there. And I also, as a mother, you know, and as somebody who went through it, it felt like a waste of energy. It is what it is. And so I didn't want to spend my time and energy getting angry about how unfair it might be. And I wanted to put that energy into beating it. And, you know, thankfully, you know, I didn't take much arm twisting with my son. He didn't feel so angry about it. Interestingly, you know, that kind of test is easier for my son than it is for myself and for my daughter. And I'm going to guess, and having done a little bit of research about this, that, you know, there's a certain kind of brain and you can sharpen that part of your brain that does better. And it's the video game part of the brain. And I shouldn't talk too much about this because I don't understand exactly what I'm saying. And it's, I read a little bit about it, but it's, you know, my son explained it to me like this, that when you're playing video games, a certain kind of video game, and I'm going to botch this, but maybe the World of Warcraft kind, where there's multiplayer.
Yes.
And you're doing your thing, but your eye always has to be on a whole bunch of other things at once to make sure nobody's sneaking around the corner doing something going to kill you.
Right.
That is how the SAT is. You have to keep your mind there, but you have to be thinking of all these things and make sure, are they trying to do that? Are they trying to do that at the same time? So, weirdly enough,
that'd be a great way to sell it.
I know, right? I
mean, what's your Warcraft score?
Yeah. I mean, I very much monitored the video games for my son because he was, you know, addicted like crazy from the time he was little. So the rule for him was he could play on the weekend. He was never allowed to touch it on the weekend, on the weekday. And then even in the end, I started monitoring him on the weekends. But I do think the amount he played sharpens that piece of his brain. And my daughter and I don't play video games. And, you know, we're good girls. If you tell us, if you give us a math problem, we're going to do it the way the teacher taught us and not miss a step. Whereas my son is like a jazz musician. Like, he's just going to come to the answer and be like, well, why do you need to know the steps?
Right.
And it's that kind of brain.
Your issue, not mine. Right.
Yeah, that does better on the SAT.
Well, we're going to take another break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about how to motivate your teenager and do well on the SAT. You are listening to Kristen Heemstra with The Art of Potential Show.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra, and I am talking with the always delightful Debbie Seer. She is author of The Perfect Score Project, and her book just came out in paperback. If you have a young person who has to take the SAT, or if you just want a good read, the book is fascinating. So, Debbie, let me ask you this. When you were writing the book, what kind of thing surprised you? What did you find out that really surprised you?
So the SAT was made by the same person who made the IQ test. And I had this sort of pit in my stomach when I read that. And because what happened was I started to think if I couldn't improve my math scores, having so much trouble, I thought, well, maybe I'm just not smart enough. And so I went and I had an IQ test taken, and I realized they felt like kissing cousins, these tests. I mean, they were not exact, but they were really close. And then when I was doing, then I sort of forgot that. Then when I was doing research on the history of the SAT for the book, I found out that the same person, you know, made the Army IQ test that made the SAT. And I thought, oh my God, we've all been duped into, you know, taking a national IQ test and, you know, we've bantied about our scores like it's nothing. And, but no one would ever talk about their IQ score because an IQ score feels immutable versus, you know, an SAT score. Everyone knows you can improve that. That's why there's a $4.5 billion industry. The fact is, I think they're probably both immutable. I mean, both malleable to a large degree.
Right.
So anyway, that was one big surprise. I'm going to say the other surprise was that the score gain, and my son gained 590 points from his sophomore PSAT, and I gained 330. Yep, exactly. They were not even the best part of the project, and those were wonderful score gains. The greatest part was that I reconnected with my son during this final moment before I sent him off to college. And don't underestimate how big and profound that is. And, you know, if you think like putting kindergarten, you know, shoes on their feet for the first time or sending them on the kindergarten bus is a big deal, where do you drop them off in the dorm? It's like you can't believe how big and, you know, happy, sad that feels. It feels momentous. Anyway, I really feel so grateful that we got to share so much time and turn it into a really positive experience. You know, everyone's got this, they hate it, it's this reviled rite of passage, and we managed to somehow turn it into a little bit of fun and spend a lot of time together, and, you know, we'll always have that, and that's what I'll always cherish. So that, I'm going to say.
It's huge.
Any parent can do it. It's not like you have to take the SAT seven times or even one time.
Right.
But just to share the experience in some way, whether it's, you know, reading the newspaper together or reading your kids' essays. I learned so much about my son from reading his essays about what he thought about politics and history and literature that I never would have known had the college board not asked me. And asked him.
Right.
So it turns into a really profound, life-changing experience, especially for him, because I don't think he'd ever had a big goal that he worked toward. First of all, I don't think he thought he was going to hit. He chose his own goal, and I think he thought, well, maybe I'll hit it, but I didn't think he was sure. And then he methodically worked his way there for an entire year, and we had grafted it out. Yeah, and after that, he became a different student. Like, suddenly he realized, wow, I can goal set and I can work my way there with little steps. And his grades went up after the SAT project. He ended his junior year with his highest grades ever, senior year better than that. And he went into college with his highest GPA, did freshman year. He did amazingly well. And, you know, I mean, he's really going for it now. So it changed his work ethic.
It sounds like it kind of evoked his work ethic. And I'm sure having a pretty girl down the street, I will say that it's a funny, you know, you mentioned that as a funny thing, but just after being a counselor for so long, when a young man falls in love with an academically motivated woman, it's amazing what he starts to do in school.
Right, exactly. So, she was a tennis player. She was she had fierce competitive energy, you know, and so she brought that to the table, and it was helpful.
Totally. And then the other thing that you mentioned, which I do think is fascinating, is, you know, senior year, it does seem like a natural time when you see a disconnect happening with parent and young person. You know, because 17, 18, you're really looking at, and to your use your analogy of the animal kingdom, you're really looking at, that's the time when they do leave the nest, you know, when kind of they are ready to go be adults. And so, you know, there is a lot of, or there can be quite a lot of conflict senior year, just as your young person is, you know, securing who they are and less needy of you and wants less restraints and is not really ready to take the reins yet, they certainly don't want to have to pay for their own food or shelter or car or anything like that, right? Thank you so much, Debbie. You have just listened to the Art of Potential show with Kristen Hiemstra.